The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
You're listening to Premier Christian Radio. My name is Muyiwa, and on The Profile this week, we have a man who's been a part of some of the biggest bands in the UK, including the Stone Roses. Nigel Ippenson Fleming tells his story of rock and roll, drugs, traveling, and now being a pastor.
Nigel Ippenson Fleming. Nigel, thank you for joining us.
It's good to see you. Good to be here.
Let me take you back. Reading about you and talking to you, you started in music earlier. Yeah. One thread that's run through your life,
yes,
is music.
It's music, yeah.
The age three,
yeah,
comes up as significant.
Yeah,
but do you remember anything of those years?
Yeah, I do. I think the key thing about it is my grandparents came over from the West Indies in the kind of Windrush kind of era. And the house that my grandfather purchased, that had a piano in it. So in some ways you could say that is a bit of divine providence, in the sense that a piano was in the house. I can distinctly remember it being there, and my first kind of like experimentation with it, and first having a go on it. So at the age of three, I can most remember is actually my frustration with not actually being able to do what I could hear in my head. So that part of the equation, I always say to people that I was very good at slamming the piano lid down before I was actually good at playing it.
Now, what island did your parents or your grandparents come from?
A small island in the West Indies called Anguilla.
Okay.
That's where my grandfather was from. And my grandmother, there's a very small island next to that called St. Martin, which is half French, half Dutch. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother was from there. So they came over to England, I think it was 1952, I think it was. And they settled in Liverpool. And the house that they bought, it had a piano in. And,
the music you would hear was from parents and grandparents playing music, or was it from school, was it from radio?
It was literally from my grandfather's record collection, which contained no secular music at all because of his belief. It was all jazz.
Okay.
So I grew up listening to Oscar Peterson and Errol Garner and guys along those lines, who he thought was okay. It was okay to listen to that. And maybe a bit of Pat Boone.
Okay.
And, you know, maybe a bit of tiny little bit of country and western, but jazz was the predominant.
Now, I guess I can understand a bit more your frustration, because with jazz players, they play the stuff and you listen and you think, wow, sounds great, and it sounds so easy.
Yes,
it sounds like, yes, I can do it. And then
and then everything just falls apart because you can't express it. Mm-hmm. And I can remember around about the age of probably around about four or five, is when my grandfather thought that it was okay to have a television, because again, it was one of those things that, you know, we didn't have one. Mm-hmm. And at that age, then I started to hear more what were early television adverts,
right?
Which was simpler to be able, because obviously I didn't read music; I could only play music by ear. So to hear adverts, or going to church and hearing stuff in church, I could basically pick out the basics of what, you know.
What was the church life like for you at that age?
It was very intense, because my grandfather was the pastor. And it was intense not only from an attendance point of view, but I'd say from learning about relationships, because our house was an open house in that sense.
But let's go back a little. Mm-hmm. Because for him, obviously, knowing what we know now about the experience of the Windrush generation,
yes,
there was a lot of rejection, which led to them establishing their own places and gatherings of worship.
Yeah.
What was your granddad's experience? Do you know of that?
Well, he worked on the in the railway industry. And one thing that I do remember is I remember our house being very, very busy. A lot of people coming and going. but he seemed to have, I think, an ability to relate with people of all types, you know, from all kinds of backgrounds. Because I do remember his earliest, the area that my grandfather settled in was a predominantly white area. So as a result of that, yes, we went to church, we saw friends that were, you know, from the same background as us. But, you know, people from work, his working background and stuff, and people that came round or people from the neighborhood were all, you know, of different backgrounds. So I remember that being a very early part of, you know, his mindset and by default my mindset as well.
So in terms of church, was he able to plug into the existing church traditions, or was he functioning outside of?
I'd say that he plugged into what was the, you know, the Pentecostal tradition that he'd kind of grown up in. And, you know, I'd guess from the community of people that had traveled over, and, you know, him being a pastor over there and then being one here. So I guess it kind of had that kind of vibration around it.
How resilient do you think, or would you say that generation is compared to our generation? Because for our generation, we a little discomfort in how people look at us, talk to us, or regard us.
Yes.
And we get very annoyed. Our walls go up. But here was a generation who they had so much more to deal with, yet they seemed to keep going, and they seemed to do like your grandfather, keep reaching over the
keep
fence.
Reaching out. Yeah.
Do you consider them to be more resilient, or do you think that we're just more educated about what's intolerable?
Yeah, I would say that they were definitely more resilient. And I would also say that that level of resilience is something that I would definitely say that he kind of really passed on to me, or made me very aware of, which was the fact that you've got to get out there and have, you know, take opportunity and don't be... his words to me were always about making sure that you were exceedingly good at your job or exceedingly good at what you did, so that the issue of your background or your race or what you look like, yes, it may well be an issue, but it potentially will be more of an issue if you make it an issue. So that was very much his idea. And, you know, struggle then, you know, the types of things that they dealt with at the time then, I think were... You know, they were remarkable in comparison to, you know, the opportunities, I would say. You know, opportunity, the answer to the majority of questions nowadays, you find, you just need to type into Google and the answer is right there.
Right.
Whereas even looking back 20 years ago to even me starting in business, the things that I had to do and what I sought out to do as ideas, they're definitely more akin with what I saw and understood from my grandparents. And critically, when he, because I spent about a 5-year period where he took me back to the West Indies to live. So living there as well also gave me a different kind of angle or slice on what hard work actually really looks like. Yeah.
Now, it's interesting, your journey. Well, I think it is. So you start with your grandfather, who's who's a preacher, but
yes,
also a layman as,
yes,
as he
yeah.
worked.
Mm-hmm.
Music is a big part of his life.
Yes.
He's very adept with dealing with different cultures, different people.
Yeah.
And you do the journey of a young man in Liverpool. You, you know, live life, you see life, then you do the journey into the world of pop music and everything that comes with that, which I'd love to hear about,
because
we'll love to know what life is.
Oh, wow.
And now here you are almost full circle back where granddad was.
Yes.
As a minister.
Yes.
As a businessman.
Yes. Yeah.
But let me just go back a little. We've talked about you growing up. What was what are your earliest memories of? What was faith like for you as a young black man?
Okay.
Now I'm talking teens.
In teens.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. From a teen's perspective. Okay. I'll put it this way. It was more challenging, I would say, to let's say, overtly express it. Yeah. So I think I knew what I knew, but I knew what I knew from a head knowledge perspective. Yeah. Mm. So I always say when I'm teaching this or I'm saying this in church, sometimes I talk about the fact that, the old hymn that says, "Blessed assurance, Jesus is mine." Mm. I believe that I knew "Blessed assurance, Jesus is mine" from the perspective that I'd been told that Jesus was mine. Mm. So and the way that my grandfather was he made sure that I knew that Jesus was mine because my grandfather said so.
Yeah.
So I accepted that Jesus was mine because my grandfather said that he was mine, and I didn't necessarily know any different. Mm-hmm. And then you grow a little bit more, and then you face a few more challenges, and you see more things. You come into contact with more people. And then eventually, I guess, your faith then moves from being head knowledge into being what I would consider to be heart knowledge.
Mm. I'd like to know that the turning point for you of was it a particular moment of turbulence that made you reconsider and make it a heart thing?
Yeah, I would say that what I will say about the Bible says this, as long as the earth remains, there'll be seed, time, and harvest. And one of the things that my grandfather did, I went to live over there when I was 8 years old. I left there when I was 13. And when I came back to England, from the age of 13/14 up until when he passed away in 1991, I was 21 at the time, he would write me letters. And at the top of every letter, he'd write he just put Joshua 1 verse 8, which says, "This book of the law shall not depart out of your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night, observe to do what it says, and then you'll make your way prosperous and you'll have good success." So for me, that that's almost like subliminal teaching from a distance that he was doing, and every time he sent the letters, it would be there. And so obviously, as I was going through my journey in life through teens and then going into the music industry full time and then getting to a point now where I'm now reaching, if you would call it, crisis or breaking point. It is at that point then where the seed of that word, I guess, starts to germinate. Mm-hmm. And then I start to see the reality of it now. It's now not just something that's at the top of a letter. It's now something that's made its journey down to heart.
You know, most of us, if we be honest, as Christians, we're keen to know about the Stone Roses, the life of rock and roll, because we want to know. But a question that's been just jumping around in my head, you've spoken a lot about your grandfather, but where was your father and where are the women in your life
at that early age? Well, first and foremost, my father, he's of Nigerian descent, and him and my mother separated when I was 3 years old, and it is as a result of that marital separation that I ended up in the hands of my grandfather. He was the one that basically said that he would take the responsibility of raising me and, for want of better words, give my mother the opportunity to reestablish her own life after a marriage breakdown.
Before we talk about your mother and the women in your life, that particular junction in your life, did that affect your psyche, your view of Nigerians or Africans? And if it did, how did you resolve that?
Okay, I would say there's been a massive journeying process in that. Number one, I would say at that period of time, early 70s, may well still be the same now, but there was definitely from my family, and I would say with some West Indians, a certain level of suspicion or distance between both of those cultures.
You see, I know it well because my school,
yeah.
Archbishop Tennyson's Grammar School, this was one of the, and it's interesting how there's injury on both sides.
Yes, yes.
Because on my side, I would get teased and bullied a lot by kids who will call me an effing African. Years later, I find out that actually, all the boys who were the biggest perpetrators in Ashbridge Tennyson Grammar School were actually all half Nigerian.
Yeah, there we go.
And then it's later on growing up that I realized
yeah.
the pain they were feeling, which yes. they were expressing to me yeah. being yeah. a Nigerian, was the pain yeah. of yeah. having had a dad who was absent.
Yes.
And then they heard what their mother's family would say,
the same,
who were
yeah.
Yeah. generally all West Indians.
100%. Yes, you know? Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's made yeah. me understand, whilst I was feeling, and it's easy, I was feeling the pain of being abused.
Yes, yes.
But
yes.
actually, what yes. was happening was coming from a place of pain.
Yes, definitely.
So
definitely.
For your family,
yeah,
they were going through the same thing.
They were going through that same thing. And what I would say from my own point of view is that, you know, when you know that something is missing, but you don't necessarily know what that is, yeah? And it is only through going through that journey, and then at a certain point, it would have been around about 2003, I got asked to be the worship pastor of a Redeemed Christian Church of God church, yeah? And it is as a result of, for want of better words, immersing myself within that church and within that culture. That
must have been a culture shock for you, though.
Well, it was a culture shock, but it was also a kind of, oh, that's what's been missing, if you see what I mean.
Right.
Because
right.
it was an understanding. It's a very, it's a weird way to use the word entitlement. But I know what I mean when I say entitlement, that, you know, there is something that you have access to and you don't know what that is. And then you get involved in a culture. And like, say, for example, even though I grew up as a musician in jazz and in gospel, learning American gospel and all of those different things, and then going into the world of pop music, when I experienced praise and worship through the eyes or through the lens of, you know, African culture and through the Redeemed Christian Church of God, that it kind of squared the circle in a lot of ways in terms of my music. Mm-hmm. It that gave me the confidence actually to be a worship leader.
Oh.
Whereas I'd always previously just seen myself as just, you know, as the guy behind the scenes that was either making the records or producing music. So a lot of things came to fruition through that. And the other lead on from there was one day, whilst at home, I decided to type my surname into Facebook to see what names would come up. And I saw a few of my surname come up. And I looked and I thought, no, I think I'll leave that. And then about 2 years later, I did exactly the same thing. And I saw three names come up. And what I decided to do was to send a direct message to one of those names. And that person turned out to be my first cousin in Nigeria. And I found out that I have four brothers and sisters over in Nigeria as a result. That happened within about 6 months of me being the pastor of the church over in Wales. Mm. So, it gave me confidence.
Now, I hear you. Mm-hmm. Gives you confidence, but that's, mm-hmm. that sort of stuff, it messes with the variables of my norm, you know.
Yeah.
What do you do with that?
Knowing
that you've got a family, and we all have a deep, I mean, I don't know about you, but
yeah.
I mean, I am a deep sense of wanting to belong.
And, yeah, yeah.
You know, having been in this country most of my life by myself,
mm-hmm.
and even though I know I have family, but you know, you want to gravitate towards those.
Yeah.
And so here you are,
mm-hmm.
This young man. Yes, granddad is a strong part of your life. Yes, yeah. you know you're clear in your mind where you belong.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this little question of this chip.
Yeah,
and then you find it, and then you realize
yes.
that there's a whole world.
Yeah.
Of the brothers and sisters. Yeah. Naturally,
yes.
You
yes.
want to ask more. What did yeah. you do with that?
Well, the first thing it's actually when I say it's a little bit painful kind of talking about it. the first part of the equation was the fact that I thought he was there. I've never thought that he was gone. Yeah. And I never, one thing about my mother was the fact that she never, ever spoke ill of him. Mm. So that in some ways led me to want to kind of find out what his story was. What led to you making the decision to leave, you know, my mother, sisters, and to go? The most painful part, I would say, of that was, I find out that I've made a genuine connection. Mm-hmm. These are real people, and they appear to know. The second part was going on to my youngest sister on that side's Facebook profile. We've added one another now, and seeing that she had a picture of me and my sister from when we were in the era when we were living in the West Indies. Yeah. So to go on her Facebook profile and see a picture of me from when I was 7 or 8 years old meant that she too was also holding on to the idea that at some point I'll connect with these guys. The third part of the equation for me was when we had the first telephone conversation, because the only thing I wanted to know was, where is he then? Mm-hmm. And then in that conversation to find out that he'd died was devastating. That much I can definitely say. It was devastating, yeah.
And you know, it's interesting to hear you because for me, being here, and I remember the years where I would ask the question, why?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I remember being adopted by a family in church.
Mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm.
And I was telling the story recently to a group of church leaders. And I remember one day I was probably about 16, and I just broke down. I was crying because I wanted my own dad.
Yes.
And I remember the gentleman who I call dad,
mm-hmm.
you know, Mr. Akinde, comes into the room, a Nigerian, mm-hmm. and he says to me, "Haven't I been a good enough father to you?"
Yeah.
And he hadn't made me cry even more.
Because
I thought, yes, you have. But you know, I've got this.
It's an invisible thing that you actually really can't. I obviously don't know because I couldn't hear, but from what I've been told, my expression of at the time when I actually heard, you know, on the phone, because I asked the question a couple of times just to make sure that she actually said that, you know, it is right. Mm. But what I've been told is the sounds that I made at that moment were classed as primal. And I think it was a heart cry for what I perceive to be a missing link.
Mm.
If I'm honest with you, the only thing that made it, it's a strange thing to say, but the only thing that made it better, feel better for me, was the fact that I discovered that he'd passed away within a couple of months of my grandfather passing away. Yeah? So me being able to go back in time to where I was. My grandfather passed away when I was on tour in America with OMD. I think we were in Texas, and I had to fly to the West Indies, do his funeral, and within 24 hours of doing his funeral, I was back in Colorado on stage in front of however many thousand people. But that point, which was the 24th, I think it is, of September 1991, that marked the commencement of my kind of steady decline, as it were, into the excesses of rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
Because my grounding with my grandfather passing, as such, had gone, and I had to carry on the mask of living. So in a way, when I found out that my father had passed away within that small window of time as well, in some kind of small way, I've been able to marry those events with what was actually happening to me in mind, body, spirit at that time in life, really.
Nigel is back with us on The Profile after the break with some more of his life journey.
Premier Christianity Magazine.
Are you fed up with fake news or bored of bad stories? We think it's time for something different. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. Every month, our team publishes stories of lives transformed, testimonies, miracles, healings, and loads more good news. We're here to encourage you, excite you, and keep you up to date with all that God is doing through His church. That's why we're proud to bring you a magazine that's different.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio. The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
You're listening to Premier Christian Radio. My name is Muyiwa, and on The Profile this week, we have a man who's been a part of some of the biggest bands in the UK, including the Stone Roses.
Nigel Ibsen Fleming, thank you for staying with us.
Yeah, good, good.
It's been something of an excavation.
You've been digging for diamonds.
And it's interesting because off air, you said it's not... I haven't talked about this for a while. It's not pretty.
Yeah.
But I wonder, though.
Yeah.
Is it so not pretty?
Well, I would say the pretty side of it is the sense that as a result of me ending up in my grandfather's hands and observing the way that he did life and observing this kind of open house mentality, and in particular, seeing the way how he dealt with people and young people in particular, I think what came out of that for me is an innate, if you were to call it pastoral, mentoring, coaching, fathering heart. So I've ended up by default with... just a load of people that I've ended up just fathering and being a role model to them alongside, my own, kind of birth for children, as it were.
So this is where we are at the moment. The pastoring is a big part of your life, not just within the church setting. You work with schools with thousands of teachers and children around the country. But before we got to that point, I mean, you talked about a point where after your grandfather had passed, it was a downward
spiral,
which I guess is where you then found yourself again in Christ. But let's talk about the rock and roll days, because that's what everyone wants to know.
Rock
no one wants to know that your middle name is Bolari. Rock and roll days. What was life like? When you think about, I think in pictures you see. When you think about the years of Stone Roses and the other bands you were in, what are the pictures that come to your mind immediately? You flip that switch.
Instantly, I think of travel. I think of locations. I think of empty. I think of rollerblading in empty stadiums waiting to sound check.
Wow! So that's stuff that we see in rock movies.
That's real. Wow. I think of in particular, and I guess it's most poignant now with him only recently passed away. The biggest gig that we did was in Germany. It was us, OMD. I was with OMD, Duran Duran, ZZ Top, and Prince, and being stood at the side of the stage and watching Prince, you know, do his thing right there. Absolutely, you know, absolutely amazing. So, yeah, the travel. One of the other things that I used to love to do was before a show, I'd love to go out to the front and just sit off somewhere where, you know, you couldn't be seen, and just watching people just file in from every corner of roads and
what
angles.
What did you find,
you know,
fascinating about people watching?
What I found fascinating about that is the fact of, you know, just the sheer devotion to what they were coming to actually see. Mm-hmm. And you know that you're on the other side of that equation, and you're a part of providing that and giving that. And, you know, the energy behind that is, you know, absolutely amazing. The rock and roll industry, you know, music as a communications tool is just, you know, it's an amazing thing. I also remember, you know, just things like the experience of television, you know, like, and what that was really like. And then being alongside other, you know, being alongside other bands who were, like in particular, being in the Stone Roses and, you know, young upstarts called Oasis and yeah, you know, Blur. Based on where we were at the time.
Because yeah, your band was really the you were at the arrowhead of, yeah, this whole Manchester
of
movement.
That movement, yeah, exactly. And for me as a musician, one of the things for me as a musician being involved in particular in the Stone Roses was the fact that obviously I'm coming from a jazz background, so I know how to play pretty much anything. And to then go into a synth pop band like OMD, which was, you know, alongside Kraftwerk and the Pet Shop Boys, mm-hmm, and Erasure, that genre, and then to be able to swap genre and be in the, you know, indie rock thing. So for me as a musician, it was great to be able to kind of traverse those kind of boundaries and, you know, and but be in two bands that are really at the cutting edge of, you know, what that, you know, industry is all about. So yeah,
let me ask you though, mm-hmm, I mean, knowing a bit about your genealogy, mm-hmm, knowing that something of that cuts through.
Yes.
And then here you are, you have a bit of that Nigerian in you. Mm-hmm. You have this very strong West Indian,
yeah,
upbringing and very strong faith.
Yes.
Upbringing.
Yes.
And then you have this great wealth of music that's, yeah, been put in you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you see how that made you something of an outlier amongst, yeah, other young black musicians?
Yeah.
Because, you know, black, yeah, musicians were 10 to the dozen, you know, you,
yes,
had great musicians, but,
yes,
they were,
yeah,
you were,
yeah,
a little out there.
I think one of the key things, and I know it's coming back to him again, mm-hmm, but I think my grandfather's input comes in again into this, because alongside my contemporaries at the time, you know, the idea was to become, you know, a session musician. So you're a session musician, you turn up, you're the guy, you're dressed in black, you go in, you play, you disappear. Mm-hmm. Whereas my idea was to be more a part of the actual entity itself. Whatever entity I was involved in, I wanted to be a part of that actual movement. I wanted to, you know, to have a voice within that, not necessarily...
Just make my money and go.
Because, and also, I didn't see longevity in that, because then you're just a hired gun. Whereas if you're going to create a legacy in terms of what you're building, it to me, it made more sense to be involved in what the identity of the music was all about. So if when it came to OMD, again, you know, synth pop melodies, no improvisation allowed as a jazz musician. That's almost like tying one hand behind your back. But I immersed myself in that and understood what that was all about. When it came to the Stone Roses, again, I immersed myself in the culture, and not just the culture, the clothing, you know, if you're in that industry, what does that look like? If you're in this genre, what does that look like? Mm-hmm. And you dress appropriately. So then you become a part of the entity rather than just someone that comes in and
Let's
goes
talk
out.
About the music. Let's mm-hmm. talk about some of the content you were churning out. I mean, mm-hmm. you talk about being a jazz musician, but mm-hmm. in terms of did the lyrics of the songs that you made, did they have any impact on you at all? If yes, what impact did that
have? In particular, I would say less so in OMD, but in the Stone Roses, and I think the reason why it made such an impact on me at the time is because obviously I think I was getting closer to my own kind of spiritual rebirth. So as opposed to me just playing the music and I'm a part, you know, I was listening more to what I'm playing. I also then was doing a lot more backing vocals and things along those lines, singing more. So you're paying a lot more attention. Mm-hmm. The Stone Roses in particular, there's a song on the Second Coming called Breaking Into Heaven. And the closer I got to the end of the Stone, of me being in the Stone Roses, and my knowledge that it was time for me to change my life, there was, in this particular song, there's a lyric that says, "How many times do I have to tell you, you don't have to wait to die? You can have it all anytime you want it. Yes, the kingdom's all inside." Now, I grew up obviously understanding the theory of the kingdom and, you know, the biblical references of that. But I was also at the point now where I was seeking to change direction. And so I was starting to make more of a join now with the fact that, yes, the kingdom of God is within me. There's something that's inside me that needs to be reborn, that needs to grow. Mm-hmm. And every time on stage that we did that song, especially getting closer to when I knew it was the end, we'd get to that particular point and I'd cry every night. And I think that was because I knew that I was coming to the end of something, but I also knew that I was at the beginning of something. It's just I didn't know what the beginning looked like.
So there's so much to talk about. You'll come to the end of the journey with the Stone Roses. Now you can look back and see, well, that was the beginning of
something
of the new me.
Yeah.
How easy was it to say goodbye? I mean, Ian Brown and the rest, these were not just workmates. Like you said, you'd immersed yourself
in the culture,
wholly into it.
Yeah.
How easy was it to say goodbye?
It wasn't easy by any stretch of the imagination. It was in some ways, it was easier to say goodbye to the physical people mm-hmm. than it was to say goodbye to the idea of who I was and who I, and then to start to, for want of better words, reinvent myself and rebuild and start all over again. And I spent 6 months over in America, and I know, you know, the phrase finding yourself is pretty overused, but I spent 6 months over in America. I got rid of all of my possessions. I literally had clothes and a small backpacker, a pencil slim kind of guitar. And I literally just traveled for about 6 months trying to understand what I could do to rebuild and restart and what did rebuilding actually really look like. Because I knew that I loved music, but I knew that I didn't want to be in the music industry anymore. I knew that I wanted stability. I knew that I wanted family, and I guess I knew that I wanted to build, to a certain extent, what I'd seen my grandfather build as a legacy, but I didn't quite know how I was going to get from here to there.
How did you deal with the emotional upheaval? That I mean, I'm assuming, because you're human. How did you deal with the emotional people, and how did that come out? Was it in tears? Was it in depression?
I would say depression was a very let me put it this way. I wouldn't have called it depression at the time, but I'd say looking back on it At a certain point in my cycle, I would say that I felt comfortable using that word, because the word in itself carries, you know, such huge, you know, ramifications, you know. So, but I would definitely say during that period of time, you know, it was, you know that scripture in the Bible says where you go to bed late and wake early and eat the bread of sorrows. Mm-hmm. That definitely was my, you know, kind of existence. I was changing, I was sad, I was hopeful, but I just didn't know, I just couldn't see where I needed to go. And so most days felt pretty much like Groundhog Day. I stopped driving, that was for a start. Also, I was in a new relationship with my now wife, and I was also exiting... I wouldn't call it a drug habit as such, but I'd gotten used to drugs being a part of my life as well. So I wouldn't necessarily call it an over-dependence, but it was a door to go through to get relief on things.
Who would you say was the most significant person at that
time?
Point in your journey?
Yeah, I'd say my wife. Yeah, I'd say my wife, yeah, because I'd known her since I was 13, and we both gone, you know, lived our lives in different ways. And when I got in touch with her with the idea of beginning a relationship, my sales pitch wasn't based on romance. It was based on the fact that I knew that I wanted to change my life. I could remember her and her aura and her mindset and her thinking. I could remember that from.
So you didn't come on the phone and say,
"No,
yo, baby love."
No. There was none of that at all. It was an hour and a half plus conversation where I literally laid out the essence of who I was and how far I'd fallen, but also how high I thought I could rise, and if she was willing to take a gamble on that, I thought that, you know, it could work.
Wow.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the now.
Mm-hmm.
You are, as I've said a few times, you pastor a church,
mm-hmm.
But beyond that, you pastor community of people.
Yeah, yeah.
You run a business.
Yes, yeah.
Which facilitates for other Christian businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Mentally,
mm-hmm.
where are you now?
Well, right now, I'm in a very interesting place in the sense that I guess a lot of, you know, sometimes you can end, you know, when you're kind of fighting for something or you're believing in an idea, and you're watching an idea grow and develop, and you have no idea of where it's necessarily kind of going to go.
Mm.
I'm in a place at the moment where I'm watching a lot of what I conceived during the early days of reinvention now actually being manifest. It's a reality. So UK churches, as an organization, we've grown to, you know, service over 500 churches and charities across the United Kingdom.
Now, very quickly, UK mm-hmm. churches.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a bit about that, because that story in itself is incredible. I mean, you just say 500 churches like that.
Yes, yeah.
It just landed.
Yeah, and the reality is UK churches started in 1999. Mm-hmm. I needed a website. I got a website my own self, but then I got into working alongside other creatives that could do so. And then as a result of that, we ended up doing a website for one person, a website for another person. And then that happened with a church. It happened with two or three churches. And I'm really proud to say that that company has grown with, you know, literally zero advertising other than word of mouth. We now look after the Street Pastors Network as well, which has got 300 websites on its own. And that has been a really great adventure, just in terms of trusting God and going through, you know, the cycles of up and down and wondering where it will go. And that's been absolutely amazing. So UK Churches is there. I pastor a church in Wales called Bethlehem Church Life Centre, which has been, again, another brilliant experience. I mean, pastoring is very, very hard and challenging work, but at the same time, my heart is for people. So the ability to be able to take ideas and share them every Sunday and then see that become the fabric of a community and then watch a community grow again is a brilliant thing. And then I guess where I am now, I'm at a place now where I've always been what I would consider to be a kingdom builder, in the sense that I believe that the reality of church exists outside of the building. But what I'm seeking to do now with my own website, or for want of, it's a bit like Nigel coming out really with NigelIppinsonFleming.com, and basically seeking to take the work that I've been doing in schools and the work that I've been doing in companies and the things through workshops and things like Thought for the Day and video casts, and really take the practical message of the gospel, or to take the tools that enabled me to grow from where I was on the 26th of August, 1996, at the end of the Stone Roses, and grow from there to now.
Do you see yourself being able to engage with either some of your old friends from the entertainment industry and sharing with them some of what you, some of the truths you now know with the tools you have?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that part of your... part of your dream?
I think part of the idea when it comes to connecting with people from that period of time is I'd say it's more to be able to demonstrate that it is possible to have a life of long-term purpose. Because one of the challenges with being in the music industry and, you know, being attached to fame and celebrity and or being known or things along those lines, it's very short. The fixes are very short term. And one of the series that I've spent a lot of time, especially in our church community, dealing with is the idea of events versus process. And I've had to learn how to become a process-driven person. You know, it's very easy for me to say UK Churches, bang, we've got, you know, 500 plus clients, but it's taken 16 years in order for it to grow from, you know, where it was at the very beginning, you know, to where it is now. I mean, one of the amazing challenges of my life at the time was that when I launched UK Churches and I wanted to build that particular business, even though I just exited being a pop musician. I was earning royalties in the music industry. I'd got married. I'd had my first child, Lauren, my first daughter. And I made the decision to go and work in a company stacking shelves, working from 11 o'clock in the night till 7 in the morning. And whilst doing that job, I had guys who were coming to me in the nighttime economy who were trying to sell me pirate CDs of music that I'd written. And I couldn't, you know, do you know who I am? You can't do that.
Yes.
But again, this is again part of that whole work ethic type thing that perhaps was more akin to the older generation. So for me, making the decision to build the business, even though I was getting royalties and being an ex-pop star, but still going, no, I'm going to go and work on the night shift and I'm going to, you know, be able to provide for my family and eventually the business will grow. That's a natural part of what I would say was put into me from a work ethic point of view, which is that's a process-driven thing. It's about being able to see long-term rather than there's no way I'd do that.
I have one more question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, I was... in the mornings when I come to Premier, I'd go for a run.
Mm-hmm.
You may not look at me and believe that. But, so I was running, and I was listening to a song that we play on Premier Gospel called Finish Strong.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I just began to cry then, because a thought dawned on me. It's incumbent on me to finish strong,
yes,
because of the sacrifice that Kayo did, Karimu Olairoju, my father, had,
yes,
made.
Yes,
Shola,
yes.
Olatunu Olairoju had made.
Yes, yes.
And I was running, this big black man, I'm on Vauxhall Bridge, I'm running, I'm, yeah, crying, I'm thinking,
yeah,
man,
yeah,
I'm going to finish strong.
Yes.
And I began to think of the things I would say to them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When I had the opportunity to see them.
Yes,
I wonder,
yes, yeah,
if you had the opportunity now to see, mm-hmm, Granddad,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and then your father who you never knew.
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah.
What things would you like to say to them?
Yeah, the instant words to both of them would be thank you. Yeah, because
thank you even to the one that
100%. Yeah, 100%. And one of the reasons why thank you to my father is because the reality is it's impossible to gauge. My father, I have one possession of my father, only one thing. It's a book by Norman Vincent Peale called The Tough-Minded Optimist, yeah? I have a book from my grandfather, which is called Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon
Hill.
No
way!
Hill, yeah, and I'm talking...
No way!
I'm talking the old... I mean like the one of the original... broken down ones of those, yeah. And I picked that book up. It was always on my grandfather's shelf.
No way!
And in 1998, before I got married, I went across to the West Indies. I went to my grandfather's house, and it was the one thing that I was after, was that book. I went to the house. Other people were living there. I went in, had a look around. That book was on the shelf. I picked it up and took it. So for my grandfather, I have Think and Grow Rich. From my father, I have The Tough-Minded Optimist. I can't put myself into the mind of what my father's circumstances were.
Mm.
That, I mean, who knows what he was already committed to before he even met my mum.
Mm.
That's a possibility.
Mm.
Who knows where he was. Maybe... with the strength of my West Indian family, he might have found that, wow, that's a little bit overwhelming. I don't think I'm going to be able to integrate.
Mm.
Who knows? So I can't put myself into his mindset, but what I do have is The Tough-Minded Optimist from him. And what I have from my grandfather is Think and Grow Rich. If you put those two ideologies together, yes, and then you rest those two ideologies on top of the Word of God, from which comes all ideologies anyway, I've been given, and then through my grandfather pointedly making sure that I receive Joshua 1 verse 8, I've been given really the keys to create anything.
Wow.
Whenever you want. So thank you would have to be what I'd have to say, because what they gave me was something that's more, you know what they say, if you give a man a fish, you know, you feed him for day.
Mm.
If you teach a man how to fish, which is what I believe I got through my grandfather and through experience, you teach a man how to fish, well, then you feed him for life.
Nigel Bolanle Ibsen Fleming, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
well.
You.
Thank you
thank
very
you.
Much.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio. Where faith comes to
life. Life's better with American Family Insurance. Because we know in making the most of your home, DIY doesn't just stand for do it yourself. It also means dream it yourself. And we're here to help protect the dreams you're building. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Save $100 on the Craftsman V26 Tool Power Tool Combo Kit, now at $199. No matter what the project is, Craftsman's high-quality, high-performance products empower you to build on. Visit Lowe's and check out the full line of Craftsman tools today. Valid through 7/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.